Obviously, you've been reading through all our crap.
I've been reading all of your crap. All right, now I'm recording. This is Dan Galadner, AFT archivist at Wayne State University, Walter P. Reuther Library, interviewing Tom Mooney, April 24th, 2006. Thanks for participating in this, Tom. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Excellent. Why don't we just get started with where you're born, raised, and something about your parents.
Sure. I was born in Albany, New York, and that's where my... Both my parents come from that area. My mother was raised in South Albany and family connected to the famous O'Connell machine at various levels. My father, Schenectady, then Ballston Lake, same area. But my father was up and coming with a big insurance company and got transferred to Cincinnati. Quick sojourn in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, but was in Cincinnati by about age of 12. And my father, Don Mooney Sr., passed away last September. And raised in the Albany, Schenectady area. I went to the Army during World War II, fought in the Pacific Theater. Came back, went to small Catholic college, Siena College in Albany, on the GI Bill. Got hired right out of college by Equitable Life, which was then the third largest insurance company and about seventh largest corporation in America. And stayed with them 40 years. Rose pretty high, almost to the top. Ended up starting his last assignment was in Japan for 5 years, starting a new, brand new subsidiary for them, the first American life insurance company actually to get licensed and do business there. And as soon as he retired, the Japanese bought it. But the company, parent company by then was in a little financial stress, but they made a lot of money on it. They made a lot of money on their investment. So my mom is Marguerite Mooney. We call her Peggy, and she grew up in Albany also, and went through Catholic schools there. Didn't get to go to college. Always resented it because her parents were, you know, middle class and only child. Could have sent her to college, but I guess didn't think it was. They didn't think it was that important to send girls to college. She grumbled like hell about moving out here to the provinces. But about 20 years worth of grumbling. Never really got it really like that. And didn't like the suburbs either where we were living. She was really kind of a city girl. She should have, in a night owl, she should have lived in Manhattan or Chicago or some big city. Or Buenos Aires, you know, where life doesn't start till 10 p.m., you know. That's her personal clock. So anyway, from Cincinnati, I went through Catholic schools in Albany, Harrisburg, and Cincinnati right through high school. And then took a radical turn and went to Antioch College, those were my hippie radical days. So, you know, it was a very short list of colleges that I could imagine relating to. And that one was close on the short list, but also close to home. My parents were on the rocks and wanted to be close to, you know, relatively close to mom. I liked the co-op program that they had as well, so you could actually get out in the real world. So half the time, actually, in your college years. And majored in political science there, at the same time getting a comprehensive social studies teaching certificate. So I actually was in this most of my time was spent in this hybrid program between the political science department and the, well, and a kind of offshoot. It wasn't really the Department of Ed. The Department of Ed was, I didn't find very attractive because it was very focused on sort of the Summerhill or hippie free school kind of philosophy, which actually I was enamored of in high school when I first got interested in education. That was the stuff I was reading, you know. And high school, Catholic traditional high school, seemed so repressive and straight, intellectually straitjacketed, and out of date, out of touch. That all that stuff, all those kinds of educational philosophies seemed attractive. But when I actually by the time I got to Antioch, I was becoming a little bit more left and more interested in teaching in urban environments, and this stuff didn't seem to really be relevant as much to kids who needed to get basic literacy and numeracy, and, you know, as well as ideology and, you know, understanding of the political world they lived in. And what I was really lucky, actually, because this was a very relatively brief moment in time where this partnership between a really skilled teacher and teacher educator and guy who ended up being my advisor in the political science department was just kind of getting up and running. It was called Praxis, and it was obviously designed to marry political theory and practice, you know, in terms of teaching. And we worked in teams. We would spend 5 hours developing a, you know, 40-minute lesson plan. You know, we used what we called then Freire approach to the pedagogy, which they now, you know, more commonly go back in time and call the Socratic approach. You know, kind of inquiry-based teaching and seminars and stuff, and trying to draw on, I guess, what Freire added to that was trying to draw on the in a multicultural environment that we're in here today, and we're teaching, and then drawing on the background of the kids and building on what they do know in order to link them to knowledge and information that they should know or that you'd like them to know that they might find useful.
So instead of teaching about some, let's say, the white founding fathers, there's no relationship to urban kids really understanding.
No, that's not the point. It's not that you didn't teach them. Certainly, I didn't then and don't believe in that now, that you don't teach sort of, the kids need a common cultural backdrop of the society they're living in, and they certainly need to know the political history of their country, which would include those guys, but not exclusively those guys, you know, right. Not the white founding fathers. You got that a very shallow and distorted version of history that we traditionally taught, you know, only talked about those guys and not like who was really doing the work, who was really fighting their battles, you know, on the battlefield, who were the, you know, slaves, and that a lot of this fighting was over, you know, in a couple of our wars. You have to paint a more holistic picture of a society if you want kids to understand it. Certainly if you want them to understand their place in it, given that they are not, you know, descended directly from the daughters of the American Revolution. But not that they shouldn't know those things as well. But anyway, I actually learned some pretty good and powerful teaching methods. That doesn't mean I learned how to manage an inner city classroom and deal with the bureaucracy of the school and the school system. And I certainly had, like most people, had to struggle with all that, but I did have some pretty good foundation in actually trying to engage kids and get them into interesting lessons, as well as, you know, getting exposed to a very wide range of political thought at Antioch, which certainly the entire spectrum of the left, from, you know, pretty much just countercultural to, you know, any kind of sect you could want to join, you know, if you wanted to be in a Marxist-Leninist lesbian, you know, vegetarian study group or caucus, no problem. It was there, you know.
So, what kind of groups were you with?
I never joined anything, you know, because it just seemed like a bad idea. None of them seemed to really have all the answers or be all that together. And I was just leery of joining something that could, you know, you might regret later having joined. The closest I got was probably the New American Movement, which later merged with Michael Harrington, you know, version of the social wing of the old Socialist Party. But I never even joined that. A lot of my friends were in that. This group that worked around this Praxis program in to learn how to teach politics in an engaging way. I guess to some extent, what would you have called that group's politics? I don't know, some kind of post-Maoism. I don't know. It was certainly anti-revisionist in the sense of, you know, the Communist Party crowd, and, you know, didn't look down on them, but we were fairly we weren't really easily niched, frankly, because this advisor that was our kind of our political science professor in general, he was definitely a Marxist, but he was of a very interesting and independent sort who was more interested in Marx as a social historian than as either an economist, and certainly he was very, you know, disdainful of Marx as a politician, which history shows, you know, he was not much of a politician, but he was also into Marcuse, and he was into Gramsci, you know, an Italian sort of anarchist labor movements, and who else? We have to read Lukács, who was this Hungarian political science, Marxist political scientist who was really, really dense to get through. But what I most learned from him was social analysis and texts that were about, you know, deconstructing a society and how it, you know, works and how it fits together and marrying the economics to the politics, to the sociology, to the cultural and the religious. And that was that was the real valuable stuff I got out of Marx, but also other authors that he exposed us to. So anyway, I sort of floated through, you know, a range of political circles without ever committing or joining to one, because they all at some point, you know, I used to, meeting people years later who were in other Antioch, you know, little political study groups or factions, I would say, yeah, our cult thought, or our sect, sorry, our sect thought your sect was extremely sectarian, you know. But that was Antioch in the 70s. But there was a lot of great professors and a lot of great stimulation. So no regrets. I got out of there fast, not because I didn't like it, but because I was anxious to get out in the real world and make a living. And, you know, in my family, there was a real strong work ethic. You were constantly told about, you know, how your grandfather worked two jobs and ran the farm and did the heavy housework, you know, and stuff like that. Or you would constantly get, while you're resting, you know, I want you to sweep the garage, you know, or whatever. So I just really wanted to get out there and save the world, I guess, you know, and that was the times we were in. So I got out of there in 3 years after having finished high school in 3 years. So
3 years of high school.
Yeah, so which means I started teaching at 20. And I pretty much went, you know, on the co-ops I did various kind of political stints, including two different stints of, that weren't formal student teaching, but they were intern. Well, actually, one of course did count on my student teaching. The other was just kind of an informal internship at a school. Both were alternative schools. Both were in Cincinnati. I also did a stint with the United Farm Workers basically volunteer with a, you know, I think they paid your rent and literally $5 a week, you know, spending money.
Was that in Ohio?
That was also in Cincinnati as well as in around Yellow Springs and surrounding towns around Antioch. So I stayed kind of close to home again, probably for family reasons, probably because I wanted to work my way into the work world and into the political world, and I wanted to maintain contacts and develop contacts, and that did sort of pay off in terms of things I was able to do fairly quickly out of college.
This work with the UFW, was that your first exposure to the labor union?
It was, other than, you know, my parents' generation were more, you know, my parents, not just my parents, but my parents' generation on both sides of the family, and even my grandparents, both on both sides of the family, had lost medium-sized businesses, you know, during the Depression. People did sort of, you know, professional stuff. I don't mean doctor or lawyer, but more business and commercial stuff. Previous generation had been, you know, skilled craftspeople, more railroad construction, you know, a lot of railroad in central New York. And so I didn't. I was raised with you know, democratic politics, definitely, and basically liberal democratic politics. Real strong affinity to Roosevelt and the New Deal, Kennedy's in the '60s. That was our, you know, being Irish Catholic. That was really big development, obviously. But not a lot of labor. Labor was certainly, you know, a good part of the democratic coalition, and unions are good. We need them, but it wasn't a lot of real exposure to the labor movement. And so the farm workers was my first real involvement, and it came through sort of Catholic social action stuff as opposed to directly a desire to get involved in unions. And I certainly didn't get into teaching with the notion that I'm going to get real involved in the union, and that's going to be the instrument for, you know, trying to change education or change the world or anything. It was more interested in teaching as a political activity in and of itself. And so the farm workers was a separate, was a distinct strand, and I got real involved in that in high school, actually. This does have a real direct bearing on how I approached issues and bargaining and as a leader of a teachers' union much later. Because I got real involved in this in high school as a result of one of our classes. No, was it a class? Or I was active in the World Affairs Club. I think it might have been in a World Affairs Club forum or meeting. Somebody from the representing the UFW's great boycott at the time, so it would have been around 1970 or 69 maybe even, came to talk, and this was a farm worker from California who they were, you know, sending out far and wide to various cities to help stimulate and organize support for these boycotts. And there were also some local, you know, local activists, including a Catholic priest who were sort of leading the local efforts. So we had this speaker. We didn't really know quite how to follow up and what the contacts and what the network was. So I don't know who directed us this way, but we ended up meeting with the head of the Central Labor Council, a bunch of high school kids from a Catholic high school in the edge, you know, edge, it had a district with the edge of the city and a lot of suburbs, even rural areas, a huge attendance area. So we go downtown and meet with Bill Sheehan, who's a fabulous guy. I got to know him, you know, much better later as a labor activist and teacher union leader. And he kind of gave us the overview of what was going on with the UFW and the Great Boycott and put us in touch with people who were actually working on the boycott. Got real involved in that. I mean, weekly. We ran, our little high school had had an active boycott committee that had people out every week, often in peak periods of the campaigns, multiple times per week at local supermarkets. We had a pretty steady group. And this corresponded somewhat to a social, you know, network of sort of the you know, ranging from the political activists to the merely countercultural types, you know, in this Catholic high school, which was a distinct minority. But we had a good time. We had a great impact. We would go every week into the university district, which was real exciting. You know, to have the actual weekly meeting of the citywide boycott committee, learned a lot about strategy and tactics. You know, got involved in the discussions about what was going to be most effective. Spent a long time in picketing stores where no one gave a shit about the farm workers because they, you know, we may have picked the wrong target once in a while. But most of the time, they were very smart. We picked targets in working class neighborhoods, racially integrated neighborhoods, where you got tremendous support. And we, you know, this was a huge object lesson. Watched a lot of people turn away from stores because we were telling them about either the oppression of the farm workers or how it affected them as consumers because of the pesticides. And herein lies a major, in fact, we found, especially to the extent we got out into the middle class and suburban areas, you know, as we knocked the grapes off the shelves in certain stores, we were now working our way out into more fringe or suburban type of areas where it's a tougher sell to have, you know, solidarity with the grape workers be a, you know, big value in and of itself. So we were coached by the leaders of the citywide boycott committee to focus more on the pesticides and the common ground between the workers and the consumers. And that became sort of an instinctive thing to do as I was working, you know, challenges of how to get stuff the teachers wanted when they didn't really want to strike to get it. So we'll get to that later, but it didn't dawn on me at the time that I was imitating that farm worker tactic until an interview like this with a reporter asking, you know, background questions. It suddenly dawned on me, you know, that, hey, that's where I got that notion from. You know, it just became kind of instinctive because I spent so many hours out in front of supermarkets pitching that line. So that was very influential. I also did student rights organizing in high school, around everything from the right to, you know, free speech stuff to having a say in, you know, school governance or curriculum or, you know, the usual stuff of that time. So I went back in time to, and then I did, so then in college, yeah, I picked up one of my co-ops was a 6-month stint working for the boycott committee in Cincinnati.
Excellent. So you did have a nice exposure to unionism, student rights,
yeah,
teacher rights.
And unionism as a high moral, social calling as well as, you know, just a trades union.
So this is when you go in to become a substitute teacher?
Is this kind of- I got out of college and I actually finished in September, or finished in a summer, because it was a year-round. Anyway, it was year-round, so I finished it in the summer of 74. So they wouldn't issue a diploma until spring, but I finished all the course requirements. So I was able to get, I don't know whether it was a temporary or maybe a regular certificate based on a letter from the college and, you know, all that. Of course, went to the personnel office. And I only applied at Cincinnati Public because that's where I wanted to get in. And let's see, I guess it was maybe November they started calling me to sub. I guess by the time we did all the paperwork and stuff. And subbing is hell, of course. But I didn't do that for very long. I did some subbing. It was almost all inner city. And then a position opened up at Bloom Junior High in the west end of Cincinnati, one of the oldest and poorest by then neighborhoods. Beautiful 1915 building, big high windows, a rooftop play area, which was no longer in use at the time. At least not for instruction. And the reason it had a rooftop play area was because it was in the inner city at a time when the inner city was like, you know, old time. Like this was a huge meatpacking town. So like right in the neighborhood were these big meatpacking plants and, you know, cows and bulls and stuff running loose and whatever. And right next to the school was Millionaire's Row, where meatpackers and brewers and, you know, other wealthy folks lived in these Italianate, you know, mini mansions, beautiful houses, some of which have now been restored. Kids went home for lunch. There was no cafeteria because kids, had, you know, in the old days, kids went home for lunch. So now the cafeteria was a wide place in the hall, and we had to run, you know, four shifts to feed the kids. But you know, the thing had swimming pools built in 1915. Had a boys and girls swimming pool. Which sometimes were in use and sometimes not, because there was no money for maintenance and capital. It was still a neighborhood school. Kids mostly walked to school, and it was mostly projects. This is a neighborhood that once had 80,000 people in it. That's now maybe got, I don't know if it has 8,000, maybe, no, because 10 maybe. Big chunks of it were torn down altogether, and it's now sort of light industry and warehousing sort of stuff. And then an interstate highway was plowed through and tore down a bunch of it. And then, you know, new projects were built. There's several generations of projects. We're now into tearing them down through this Hope 6. You know, they're starting to get torn down. But even in, this is 1975, most of the kids walked to school either from the old brownstones and tenements or from projects. And that was neat because, you know, they were typically way behind in academically, didn't have good study habits, to say the least, would challenge you right to the wall in terms of behavior if you let them get away with it, but really were mostly nice kids that were just going to get away with as much as you let them get away with. But it was about you learning what the right prompts are and how to you know, engage them and how to discipline them and not take the shit, you know. But that takes a while. They didn't really teach us that in college. You know, in most cases, unfortunately, they still don't. But the nice thing was, if you called parents, you got backing in those days. And if you couldn't get backing out of the parent, sometimes you find that the parent wasn't responding, or the parent was responding and sounding very concerned, but nothing happened. And then you figured out, you know, you're pushing a button that's not connected to anything, and you got to find who's really running this. And in those days, though, there was more likely to be a grandma who was up from the deep south, who was from the country, in other words, and was not about tolerating bad behavior on the part of children, you know, and didn't see that as necessary at all. And if it was happening, it was because somebody was letting it, and so it wasn't going to be on her watch. So if you found grandma, it was gold, even if the parents weren't all that in charge or together. Sometimes you, in fact, got a little too much support as you call home and you could hear the screams at the other end of the phone, or when the kid was getting whooped, or the kid would come in the next day, you know, limping. Mm-hmm. But you would definitely get, then you would feel bad, but you would definitely get some backup most of the time. The school was pretty much out of control, though, because the principal was real weak and didn't come out of his classroom until about, you know, third, out of his office till about third bell. And no, I'm wrong. This was a school where he would make his rounds first bell before anybody woken up. And then you'd never see him the rest of the day. And the rest of the day, things would slowly, steadily deteriorate. And there were two assistant principals that were trying to keep it together. So that was interesting. I mean, that was about me trying to put some of these skills in lesson planning and engagement to work, but having to learn how to just manage kids and manage all the bureaucracy and your reporting and everything you had to do.
Was this all on you? Just discovering yourself how to manage a classroom?
Yeah, pretty much. No, that and the kids teach you. The kids don't really want the class to be out of control, so when you keep them after school, they will tell you. It's very explicit. Mr. Mooney, when so-and-so did this, here's what you should have done. Now, this one will not, he won't save the attention, so what you got to do is this, you know. And the other, really interesting thing, and this was a real lesson to me, I took over a class mid-year, which is always really hard, mm-hmm. and they were used to, you know, a certain routine. And the person I took over from was a white, West Side then was, you know, the German and some Irish and some other ethnic, you know, groups, very Catholic, very white. You know, he was a classic West Side German. I was teaching American history and black culture. This man left me a collection of materials to teach black history, black culture that I hadn't seen the like of since in the schools. Okay, so he didn't, like, he had a certain stereotype. And here I was with boots, long hair, you know, hippie radical, from the east side of town, you know, thinking those West Side Catholic, they were like, that was the conservative, racist part of town, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was in many ways. But this guy did not fit the stereotype. There were also a lot of white teachers from the West Side that had been just transferred there the year before under a faculty DSEG policy. The district was embroiled in DSEG litigation then. To sort of take the heat off or buy some time, they didn't want to desegregate the kids, but they went ahead and integrated the faculties by just massive transferring people around. So you had a bunch of, you had three groups of people. You had these white teachers that had just gotten there from the West Side, which were then, you know, not so today, but then, you know, very white, kind of middle class or upper working class type of neighborhoods, in shell shock, totally. Mm-hmm. You had older black school teachers, and Cincinnati has a very old black middle class. You had very professional, very stern, very middle class, cultured kind of people who, frankly, also kind of looked down on these poor, you know, ghetto kids. And then you had younger black teachers who were kind of with it, and I learned a lot from a couple of them especially. And they were tended to be the strongest union members, too. But it was a very strange environment. It was very strange. There were three or four different places where people ate lunch. The faculty was very fractured. But like I said, this teacher I inherited from, kind of I grouped him with these other, you know, West Side white teachers who, like, couldn't deal with where they were. No. He had the kids under control. He had a real good curriculum going on. And so, naturally, when you're taking a major, that's all I heard. Mr. Arnsmeyer would have done this. Now, usually on Monday, Mr. Arnsmeyer does this. You know, when Johnny did such and such, this is what Mr. Arnsmeyer would do. So, eventually, it's hard to get control back, you know, once you lost it. So, in September, start a new year, you know, you apply the lessons. But the kids really, unfortunately, you know, the limitation of that, of course, is what they're teaching is what they know. Which included corporal punishment at that time in that place, which included, you know, not necessarily all the best pedagogical practices, but, it, you know, it was what they were used to. And so to get them kind of to come to terms, you had to do some of that. So that was fun. But then I got elected building rep first thing I had to do was learn the language, the dialect, I mean, to be perfectly honest. They would sit there and talk, and I didn't always understand what they were saying. Mm-hmm. But I was, on the positive side, I was fascinated by it because I was very interested in dialects of all sorts, and I was very interested in the culture and the kids I was dealing with, and I had learned all this free area stuff as well as my own natural inclinations, I guess, or family inclinations. So I learned it fast, but at first it was like, you know, and I actually had to go to some of the teachers and say, what, you know, what does this mean? Sometimes it wasn't, you know, appropriate language for the classrooms. They would like play it off, but mostly I would get translations. I really liked the kids. I really enjoyed the kids, even when they were, you know, getting the better of me some days. I really liked them, and I liked being in a neighborhood school. So then I got, by the end of the year, I got elected building rep. There were some political issues that rose that I, you know, I guess took a stand on and within the building.
So basically at a meeting you actually ask the question and you get elected.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. nobody was all that anxious. There was some, they tried to make a sign of loyalty. There were some other strong union people in the school, but if this young eager guy is willing to do it, fine. So I got elected building rep and then immediately got surplused. Not because I don't think of being elected building rep, just because, you know, there were staff changes. Surplused in, or excess, meaning involuntarily transferred out, got to find a new school.
Was this with this federation or with the association?
At that time, the association was the bargaining agent. So to degree, you want a little bit of that
Sure.
Yeah, how that happened.
Yeah.
We had a local in Cincinnati who chartered, in like a lot of the urbans and other locals in Ohio chartered during the Depression. That local lasted until the early 50s. I actually commissioned, when I became local president later, some research on it, and got somebody to do a history master's paper on the history of this other local, and he did a bunch of oral histories, which somewhere the tapes still exist. You should have those.
I think I do.
Yeah. And we did some. We wrote some articles in our paper based on our local paper based on the research. It was fascinating. But then the local was chartered again in '64. Typical thing in those days. Mostly high school teachers. Mostly males that started it. They went to Chicago. So a company went to Chicago to AFT headquarters and meet with the leaders at that time. And they worked pretty fast. And in '68, they went on strike. It was the second, as far as I can make out, it was the second teacher union strike in the state. The first one was in Youngstown in '66. I believe we were second in '68. Hmm. And it was the Federation, which was the minority by a lot at the time, that called the strike. Oral history has it, we closed about half the schools with the support of other unions, which, you know, that kind of solidarity was much stronger in those days. Mm-hmm. In terms of AFSCME, operating engineers, Teamsters not delivering stuff, postal, you know, letter carriers not delivering stuff. But you know, the majority of the teachers at that time were still in the association, which was no way, shape, or form a union, you know, at that point. The strike lasted, I think, a week. Our president went to jail. It was injunctions. I mean, strikes were illegal.
Right.
There was no bargaining law. The only thing there was about a two-paragraph thing called the Ferguson Act that says if you strike, you can get fired. And using that, you know, just the fact that it was illegal, they didn't really fire masses of people very often, but they would go get injunctions and impose fines and all that. And the president went to jail. There's great photos of him, of his kids having a vigil outside of jail. This is a guy who was a really good knack for media and good inspirational leader, Irish Catholic, that at that time, I don't know if he had that time, but he ended up having 15, maybe even 16 kids. So a lot of them were outside the jail having a vigil, kind of like the Edie Shanker mm-hmm. picture outside the jail. It's a really good one. Anyway, the point is that the principal demand was collective bargaining. We want an election to select a bargaining agent. Again, the oral history is that they agreed to, well, there's all sorts of maneuvering going on during the strike, that they agreed to have an election that happened right away, and we had to decide to, you know, go back to work to vote or stay out, and that they stayed out during the election. This may have been a deliberate ploy, because we knew we weren't going to win. That's a guess. Mm-hmm. So sure enough, the association wins the first election. The district insists that the Federation also come to the table, because after all, we're the ones that went on strike. What's the point of having a deal with the association if we're not going to honor it, you know? Mm-hmm. Things were in ferment then. There was, again, no bargaining framework for exclusive agency, et cetera. So we're at the table. It was the best contract the association ever got. And that I know because I've read them all. I mean, that isn't just oral history. There were things in there that they lost, you know, the next time, and they lost some more ground time after that. There was by that point there's now a framework, there's at least a voluntary agreement as to how we do recognition elections, and you know, each time there was one, that the ground rules in the agreement got changed some, but there was at least beginning to be precedent. So we petitioned under the terms of the first, you know, agreement for an election. We petitioned and got another election in 71, came very close in the second one. In 74, we lost a little ground, still came pretty close. And then the association blew it in a couple of major ways. One is they fractured internally. Then president decided to, she was going to run for another term, even though she was term limited, and pushed through a constitutional amendment that was disputed. That's all I can remember for sure as to whether it was validly, you know, properly voted on. Second, this massive desegregation of faculty and transfers occurred, and they staged their one strike primarily in protest of that. It lasted 3 days. They went out 3 days before the Easter break, which was kind of dumb because it took all the wind out of your sails then, and they went back to work, and the sense was they didn't get anything. You know, mm-hmm. it was sort of a flop. We didn't honor it. That left, you know, that's a tough decision, but, you know, that leaves bad blood for years. There was a long, long period, in other words, of two organizations in the city, like there wasn't a lot of cities at that time. In 76, we finally won the bargaining rights by a decisive margin, in part because of their somewhat collapse, you know, in the eyes of the teachers and internal splits. So I come in other words, to teach on the union is in its run-up to finally getting bargaining rights. And I joined the Federation, I probably would have, just on general inclination of this is the real union. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm getting newsletters. There was somebody putting newsletters in our boxes, you know, on a regular basis. I liked the tone, the spirit. It was as appropriate to a minority trying to become a majority. And, you know, it was A, more liberal, more progressive. It was strongly and explicitly in support of the DSAG suit that was pending. It was seemed to be very inclusive, you know, come around and you can get involved, which proved to be the case. It was feisty. It was whistleblower, you know, like some of it was whistleblower type stuff, but, you know, giving voice to teachers' frustrations about the way the system worked, not just about salaries or benefits or whatever. So it was an easy decision in which to join, and I did start. I didn't get outside of my building except, you know, much of that first year. I got to be building up by the end of the year, got surplus. Went to another very interesting school, a school that had just opened in 1970, a middle school that was spun off from the high school across the street, which was a much older school. Result of that was the less senior teachers got moved over to the middle school, so it was a very feisty group. It was a very strong union school. It was much more cohesive than Bloom. There were just a handful of association members. I mean, and I wasn't the union leader by any means. There were other people, you know, already established there who were active in the union, and I was happy to be a follower and, you know, help out and, you know, provide whatever little tactical suggestions I could from my other activist background. One of the interesting, as a place to teach, it was also in some ways better, in some ways worse. It was much larger territory, so it wasn't as, you know, kids rode buses for most. It wasn't like a neighborhood school, but you still got. It's still true that you got pretty much parent support, and particularly if you were smart enough to get to figure out who's in charge in this family, it might not be mom, might not be dad, it might be, you know, dad wasn't there every day, but he was in fact the disciplinarian. I mean, you just had to figure out what was going on. And my best trick was, kids would not give you phone numbers. Maybe some didn't have phones, but mostly they did, but they didn't want to give them to you. Wouldn't give you the right number or even the right address. Or they moved a lot, you know, so you couldn't catch up with them. And especially if they were acting up and they knew it, they didn't want you to find the parents. So my best trick was, or in a case where the parent wasn't working, you know, wasn't working to get talk to the parent. Got to get to grandma. You know, how do you do it? Came up with a brilliant idea. I'm sure lots of people have done this, or some people would just, because they're connected to the community, would just know it. But from coming more as an outsider, I said, where do they go to church? The kids, unlike our generation, these kids would rat each other out in a second. You know? We were tight. That's the other trick to teaching, is you know that unfortunately the kids will rat each other out. It's not necessarily behavior you want to encourage, but you got to do what you got to do. Such and so Baptist, okay? The other thing I figured out is you call the church on Saturday to get the church segmented. You can't call on Sunday. They're all busy. During the week, there may not be anybody there. Preacher's too busy, but you get the secretary. Hi, I'm so-and-so, you know, Mr. Mooney, Crest Hill, so-and-so's teacher. Hello, how are you, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm looking to try to find, I understand his family goes to church. I'm looking for, try to get in touch with his grandma. You wouldn't have to have her number. I can't give you Mr. So-and-so's number. Why? Blah, blah, blah. I said, I know, I'm sure that's the case, but boy, he sure is acting up in class, you know. Oh, is that right? You know, well, what's going on? So I said, here's a number, you know. So next day the kid comes, I didn't get my grandma's number. We didn't have a lot of trouble out of that kid after that. So you have to learn those tricks. So yeah, I like teaching. A lot of good teachers, not some bad teachers. You would put me in the middle, struggling, trying to get there. After a couple more years, I think I was getting pretty good. But strong union school, very, very active and militant. And in fact, probably one of the seminal episodes, really, of the union's, you know, sort of march to bargaining rights was at this school. We had a wildcat strike, and we were fired up. We were ready. We were acting like we were the bargaining agent at this school, right? Because again, there's no real legal framework at this time, anyway, and there were very few association members. And we were involved in the citywide union activities as well. But one day, the principal wasn't a bad guy. Called in a teacher who was a union member for a disciplinary conference. So we knew this, you know, he needed to have somebody with him. We had been to enough, you know, workshops to know the basics. And we approached, it wasn't me, it was one of the people who was probably the building rep who approached the principal and said, we want to send, you know, somebody in with this teacher. And the principal said, no. The question of having the association rep there, I don't even think that really came up, because it was clear that they didn't represent him and they didn't represent, you know, the majority. So we figured we had to do something. This is where I think I might have provided a little tactical advice to the folks who were the leaders that others would follow, you know. And so we wanted to essentially, you know, put down our tools. We knew we couldn't walk out, you know, with all these kids in the building, and that was the dilemma. We wanted to do something strong, but what was it? Because we couldn't just walk away from the kids, so we brought all the kids to the auditorium. And so it was essentially a sit-down wildcat strike. We just brought all the kids to the auditorium, and we sat them down, and they're like, what the hell's going on? And is there going to be a movie, a speaker, or whatever? And we just told them, so we had somebody go up to the mic and tell them, we're having a little disagreement with them. Principal, and you know, we just needed to, you know, stop teaching for a little while. We'll get it worked out. They're like, yeah,
yeah. The kids love that.
Can we help? What do you want us to do? So, they were pretty good. They were curious about what is going on.
You know? Did you explain it to them, the fundamentals, or?
I don't think we did. Yeah. I think we made a judgment. We didn't want to drag them into the middle of it or start naming names. You know, it was right. Like, it would get messy. We just told them it was. We let them know it was a labor dispute. You know, that was it.
Okay.
So somebody went and dealt with the principal. My assignment was call the union headquarters and let the president of the local know that we were on strike. Well, I'm naive. I'm thinking he's going to be rushing right out there, and he's going to be like, what can I do to help? Should I call the president? I don't know, you know, whatever. Now, I didn't know what you were supposed to do next, but, you know, I figured he was supposed to know that, right? He was like freaked out. You shouldn't be doing that. It's not legal, or you know, I don't know. I can't remember what he said exactly, but I clearly got the impression of a weak, you know, somebody who was not up to the battle that we probably needed to engage in. So I just reported that back, and they went, yeah, that figures. You know, so we didn't really need him that day a whole lot anyway. So that was I had a second later experience as when I was local president with a wildcat that had nothing to do with organizing, but it was interesting. It was a health and safety. Wildcat, actually. So that was a seminal experience. So that would have been getting to be I don't know whether sometime during the 75-6 school year. So meantime, I started going to, you know, Saturdays and volunteering, or after school and volunteering at the union office. And it was a period where if you came around a couple Saturdays in a row, you'd be chairing a committee. Mm-hmm. And I got to be an area coordinator, which really was where I learned about organizing. And so in the build-up to the bargaining election, I was an area coordinator. And by this time, you know, as it gets closer to the election, there's a lot of AFT staff or borrowed staff in town. And I don't know if I knew all this then, but I've learned new since that basically the AFT drove a hard bargain in that campaign because they didn't have a lot of confidence in the local president either, and he didn't intend to interfere in stuff he didn't know much about. So they struck a hard bargain that we're going to send in one of our best people. We got to finally deliver this local, things look right, but you got to get out of the way. In other words, it had to be the Nat rep is in charge of the campaign.
So they sent a Nat rep to assist.
Yeah, well, they had always given a lot of help, I think, in past elections, but this one they were insisting on, you know, control, mm-hmm. and that was good. Now, our second vice president, director of organization, local, was fabulous. In and of her, she had great organizational skills and instincts of herself, but she also knew enough to work with the Nat rep and take, you know, take direction when needed. But she's the one who really motivated and worked with us, you know, month in and month out. She's a sweetheart. You know, she made it fun. You know, it was a lot of social life. She tried to hook people up, you know, play matchmaker, you know.
Because it was,
right, you got to have that social, you know, cohesion. And this is Sharon Cole, who you may know, you know, who later married John Cole and went down to be his director of organization. But she was our key person in this formative period. So anyway, I got downtown. I got where I used to teach, and the schools in that area. I lived up on the hill near the university, and I could walk over to the park and look down on all my schools. I thought that was so cool. This is my territory. And it was all pretty much West End. There aren't very many schools there now, but I think it was West End and some of the Over the Rhine schools, which is the other old historic neighborhood that gets so much bad press these days. And I figured this was going to be relatively easy. This is the inner city. One, the teaching conditions are more difficult. People might feel more need for representation. The folks who get there tend to be the low seniority people, or these folks that have been transferred down there and don't even like being there. I figured it's going to be easy. It wasn't that easy. It wasn't that it was hard so much. I thought it would be better. I thought these would be strong union schools already. No, most of them weren't. Some of them didn't even have a building rep. It was odd. I don't really know why this is, except that I think part of it is that a lot of the teachers that have been there before the transfers were the older black school teachers who were very association and who were very into unions. You know, this is a profession. I'm a professional. And, you know, my husband might be in a union, or, you know, my daddy might have been in a union. Nothing wrong with that, but that's not, you know.
Teacher doesn't
That's
do
not
that.
What teachers do.
Right.
And they were very leery of this, you know, hippie radical kid coming around telling them what they ought to do. And I learned a lot from them, too. And so it was a lot of work, but we got it together. It was ripe, actually. It was ready, but it had just not had, territory hadn't been worked.
You had to do a lot of legwork.
Yeah, I mean, I had to do a lot of cold calling. I had to do a lot of calling through lists to find a building rep, you know, to have enough conversations with enough people to figure out who I would want to be the building rep, and then call them back and say, hey, you know, we really need somebody. Blah, 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 would you do it? But it was cold calls. It was like my daddy going out knocking on doors selling insurance. So that was my first real organizing stint. And under Sharon's, you know, tutelage, whip, you know, et cetera, we made progress. And then there came the bargaining election, and we won it by a big margin. A lot of lone staff, a lot of people helping, learned a lot from folks from different locals that were there, as well as from Nat reps. And then we went right into getting ready to bargain. The school board kind of threw down the gauntlet right away. We won this election in December of 76. The association's contract had been negotiated through 77 because they wanted to, you know, they thought that would be an incentive to keep them in. And they had a 3% raise that was in that contract due to be paid in January 77. The board said, we ain't paying it. Y'all voted in a different union. We have a contract with this union. You voted in a different union. You got to negotiate from scratch. Well, that was A, to try to make us look bad. B, try to just throw down a gauntlet, and it certainly did. And it was like, okay, you voted in. You think you voted in a more militant union? Let's see how militant y'all are. You know, that was basically what it was about. And this is a very, you know, non-union town. This is an old industrial town. It's like a company town. Not with just one company, but sort of a multi-company town in terms of its politics and the way it's run, and most of these industries were non-union, and if they didn't have union in their factory, they sure didn't plan on having one in their schools if they could prevent it, setting a bad example for their future workers. I mean, it was that kind of mentality, that kind of town in those days. It didn't change that much. So they were ready to take us on. The school board were all, you know, basically corporate lawyers that represented the, you know, local ruling class, you know, did work for their companies. So then I volunteered for the bargaining committee. I was still an area coordinator. Volunteered for the bargaining committee, and we spent all of Christmas break and a whole bunch before and after, you know, drawing up a absolute manifesto for transforming public education in Cincinnati, voice on everything, you know, not just money. I mean, it was a very broad vision. I think this is fairly typical, too. The teachers first unionized it. When I would say, literally, my gut would say about 50% of what was really fueling this drive at this point was money or just economic status, and about half of it was not having any voice in anything and being treated like peons, you know, instead of professionals. I really do think that was about 50-50. But we were poor. I mean, We were the working poor at that point.
What was the average salary?
I have no clue what the average was. I started in 75, my first contract at 8,700. Lots of people could top that, especially in those days. A lot of people, I started in 52 at, you know, 33,000, whatever, but, or hell, at 62 for not much more than that. The big thing, though, if you think about the times, high inflation time period, right? Vietnam War, fuel inflation. It took me 5 years to break 10. That's really a more relevant statistic in a way. And a whole generation, lots of new teachers came in the 70s, you know, mm-hmm. Generation that was influenced by other movements, you know, going on at the time. If they hadn't been involved, at least it was part of the backdrop that if you have a grievance or you're pissed off about something, you know, you organize and you do something about it. But it was a time when you couldn't, you know, the GI, there were no such thing as them FHA 5% mortgages that our parents bought houses on. The only houses we could afford, unless you had other means or parents, you know, where they were helping, you were talking about rehabbing houses in the inner city. That's where my generation of teachers, you know, were either renters or buying, you know, pretty beat up houses somewhere in the inner city and, you know, fixing them up, which is what I ended up doing later. So anyway, we're the gauntlet has been thrown down. We formulated this manifesto of transforming the schools in the form of our contract demands. Then Bob Bates comes in, and of course his first assignment is to shape up our demands. Let's get a little bit real. Well, we resisted pretty hard. By the way, I learned a ton from him. Tremendous respect for Bob. But you know, we did push back and said, no, we really want to keep this one, you know, or that one. But he shaped it up somewhat, the package. He was supposed to be our chief negotiator and get us through the overall fight for the first contract. Once again, the local president reverted to form and got in the way a lot, especially as things got tough. But meantime, this was exciting for me, and I got after being on the bargaining committee and, you know, being active and hopefully helpful in some ways. I actually got picked to be on the bargaining team. Went to the table. I was, I guess, the young Turk, you know, representative, so to speak. And you know, at this point, I'm what, 22 maybe.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Real young Turk.
So that was a hell of an experience. So then we bargained for a few months, and we went on strike. So I'm now still an area captain or an area coordinator. Turned into, once we go on strike, they call us strike captains, area strike captains. And on the bargaining team, so this was real, and teaching full time, so this was pretty intense but fun. I got a new territory as an area coordinator, I think around the first of the year, as we were kind of building up toward what at least most of us thought was we were going to have to strike. And this was West Side. This was the West Side where, you know, other than the ones who'd been transferred into the inner city for DSAG, it was still pretty much conservative white. Well, relatively speaking, conservative white teachers association dominating the membership. Although by this time, after all these wars, a whole lot of people are not members of anything. They're like plague on both your houses. As I get in there to organize to support the contract bargaining team and later to support the strike, I got the black teachers that have been transferred out, you know, for DSAG, the music teacher, the art teacher, probably the phys ed teacher. Maybe a couple of other oddballs, but it was tough. We did not have a majority of people in these schools ready to support the union. I mean, association members are feeling righteous about you didn't support our strike. Fuck you, you know, you think you're so militant, but be militant, you know. I mean, it was very split. That's definitely the downside of those long years of, you know, battling for representation rights. But we got to April, couldn't budge them. Basically, they were offering us nothing on nothing, language, money, anything. So we pretty much had to strike, and we did. We claimed we had 60% out. I bet it was more like 50, you know, at the beginning. God knows by the end, because there began to be a, you know, trickle back to work. Not a you know, huge flow, but a trickle. And we were out for 4 weeks.
Ooh.
So this was the epic Cincinnati strike. We had a ball. We had a long bout of warm, sunny spring weather.
Lucky.
We all got sunburned out there on the picket line. I was running back and forth between the bargaining table and checking on my schools and bolstering the lines. And we sent people from strong schools to help picket at the weaker schools. We had a couple of wild characters from Philly out working with us at that time, running around West Side schools acting a little crazy. I mean, acting, I suppose, normal by, you know, East Coast Union standards, mm-hmm. but it was a little, some of it might have been counterproductive. Ted Kirsch was one of the people, not in the strike, but he was there during the run-up to the during the bargaining election campaign. He was great. A couple other characters from Philly were there during the strike. They loaned us. So that was, you know, that was a tumultuous, ugly thing. I mean, you can imagine what it does to a city, especially at that time. Everybody was freaked out. The mayor was a labor mayor, a mayor that came out of a dairy workers union. It was kind of a political, part of a political dynasty family, the Lukens, whose nephew was our most recent, not current, but most recent mayor. His father was a city council member, state rep, and then congressman for a long time. His brother of this mayor at the time was also a city council member, later became a long-serving congressman. But anyway, their labor mayor came out of the milk drivers, which had been part of the Teamsters. He bucked the Hoffa people, had to hire bodyguards, had goons following them around, took them out of the Teamsters, took his local out in those days. And he was a tough son of a bitch, and we always thought he was on our side, but now he's mayor and his damn schools are closed, mm-hmm. disrupted. We didn't certainly close all, we did not close the schools in general. We severely disrupted, some, to all the way from, their handful of subs that don't know what they're doing to schools that were, maybe 25% of the teachers were out and the rest regular teachers were in, whole spectrum. But his priority was to get us back to work, so he went. I didn't perceive it. I remember one meeting with the bargaining team and Bob Bates and in his office where he basically screamed at us about, he had some little deal to offer. I basically, thought it was bullshit, and so did most of the team. So you were shocked to find you were kind of out there, without a lot of support from the establishment.
Did you get support from the community and other unions, or
we weren't in a, I mean, we were following a fairly traditional union path, and even my thinking hadn't really been broadened that much. I don't remember a whole lot of real serious work at community building community support before we went out, or it was more like getting labor support was of course important, but it was a little too narrow of a view of what you needed to do to win. But in the end, and they didn't, of course, the other thing is the school district is, in fact, financially very hard pressed. This was a very tough time financially in the whole 70s, really. The state in the mid had just put in 74 this Ohio version of Proposition 13, which meant that we weren't yet feeling the full effects of it, but we were pretty broke. The way it works is it was law then, and later they put it in the Constitution. You pass a levy, which before this proposition, you'd pass a tax rate, we're going to pass a levy of 6 mils for schools. If your property value went up, you'd pay 6 mils on the new value. Well, this is, again, a high inflation time, so this is what Proposition 13 was reacting to. This as of, ever since 74, you pass a levy and it may say 6 mils on the ballot, but in reality what you're approving is the dollars that 6 mils brings in now, and it will never bring in more dollars. So every few years you have to go back to get another levy just to adjust the revenues for inflation, much less if you want to meet any new challenges or do anything different. So that was starting to take hold. But also the district had not passed a levy in years. It was partly big controversies over DSEG. The peak of enrollment having passed and beginning to have to downsize and close schools, the baby boom was over, in other words, and so that's always very divisive. And then labor strife also played into some people's perceptions, I think, of we're not sending them more money until they calm down or something, and a not very strong union town. So we were kind of broke. Point being that we settled after 20 days. Calendar month for one time 6% raise, 3-year contract, one-time 6% raise, reopeners, economic reopeners for the second and third year, neither of which was successful, ever got to conclusion. So we got a 6% raise for 3 years. Mm. We did get the building blocks of a contract. We certainly had much better language on sort of working conditions and rights and stuff than the prior association contract. And we got a big